Earl Middleman started out wanting to be a writer. He got a philosophy degree from the Johns Hopkins University and promptly hitchhiked out to Montana to experience the profundities of life as a ranch hand. He spent a few summers there, and in the winters, he'd migrate south to New Orleans. He had a girlfriend there who declared to him one day, "A writer you already are. We'll make a painter out of you." She taught him the rudiments of painting, and he started doing tourist portraits in Pirate's Alley for 50 cents apiece. Middleman says people were pretty uniformly dismayed with the results. The simple fact was that when the young artist tried to paint a portrait, it turned out more like a caricature. Features were distended, and gazes were cockeyed and riddled with angst. Middleman's painting style has stuck with him since his New Orleans misadventures in the 1950s. He's now a painting professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art and an extremely successful artist in his own right. The painter is a revered Baltimore icon and a respected teacher. He's also a great raconteur and a generous host, as the Signal's Aaron Henkin recently found out.
Yeah, well, this has like a skylight up here, which I can pull a curtain. I pull a curtain over it to keep the cold air.
I had the pleasure of visiting with Middleman at his downtown row house one evening earlier this week, and we sat down to talk about his life, his memories, and his expansive theories on art making. The subjects of his paintings vary widely, from portraits to cityscapes to still lifes. But one thing they have in common is their appearance under natural light conditions. It's absolutely insisted on by the painter, who considers artificial light a dead and unchanging entity.
But if you're out doing a landscape or even in the studio, the cloud comes over, there's this kind of emotional pulse of some sort of organic life to the light itself that, you know, I like to get into the painting somehow, that I'm not ossified into some sort of vinegar-based preservative, but rather that there is this chance of a sudden swelling of light, a sudden loss that's, you know, makes it difficult, doesn't hold still. The electric light also makes it too easily to be dominated by your own will, and it makes it a more solipsistic kind of enterprise. And also the urgency. If you're out doing a landscape, for example, if the light hits a tree on one side in the morning, it hits it on the other side, so you can't follow it through the whole day. So you only have a certain time and frame to in order to complete it. You know, you have to kind of wrestle with nature. You know, you try to pin it before it gets the best of you. You know, it's a match of exerted energies, you know, you and it, you know, and that it's a presence that, you know, light serves to illuminate in a way, as to use that metaphor. You know, light becomes the factor of conveyance. It substantiates the fiction and makes it more truth-bearing for me.
It's almost like every time you look up and then let down at your canvas, you're just painting the memory of the last time you looked up.
Well, that's an interesting thing you say there, because I often thought of like painting as being like a series of accidents. To actually see is really a kind of an engagement with the shifting perspectives and the lost and found and the presence and its absence as you encounter nature. And so that becomes one of the central things. And then at the end of it, you're kind of surprised by the image. The image is not there beforehand. It's a revelation and a surprise to me. It has a certain kind of ugliness sometimes, or a kind of vulgarity that startles me. And as a person of great breeding and good taste, you know, I'm kind of surprised at the depths of vulgarity my work takes me toward. But it's really the sense of something that's, you can't really see the whole thing. And so what you have is like these little fragments of sight. When you're looking at something, you go through a lot of different sort of focuses. And these focuses you assemble, and that makes your style and makes your image somehow, in some mysterious way, really. Each artist is different. You assemble that, the rhythm of it, its occurrence. It's discoverable in time, but it's also the gestalt of it all somehow you have, perhaps. You know, so that while you're doing one little part, you only see the part, you know. And, you know, one of the things is if you get really close to something, you can't see the hole. So a lot of times I like to get very close to the subject so that I'm not able, the further back you are, then you can probably get a picture of the whole thing somewhat. But as you get closer to it, then you're really involved in, you know, kind of disjuncted fragments. And like each mark that you make is like a mark of memory in a certain way, because as your eye turns away to the page, then you're negotiating with the page what you see and your own present history, the way you think it should be, and the way it's actually turning out, you know, which is something else. So it's all these different factors. And the image is always different than anything that I could have thought of beforehand. And the sense of the whole actually becomes an emergent newness. I mean, you recognize it, but then on the other hand, hopefully it's a kind of surprising new kind of take on it. I can't even find where it says. There it is. It's a titanium. Yeah, so that's not as heavy as the lead.
Middleman grinds his own paints on a marble countertop at the top floor studio of his row home. He complains that commercial paints are impregnated with additives to extend their shelf lives, and when he makes his own, he can get maximum pigment to the vehicle. But it also seems aesthetically appropriate that this artistic throwback would have a corner that looks more like an apothecary than a studio. He seems to revel in the organic mess that surrounds him, and when he puts paint to canvas, he's not interested in things like the efficient and well-ordered gleam of a modern cityscape.
I go to the parts that people don't really look at, you know, like piles of old tires and old containers with a lot of, you know, kind of junkyards along the Fairfield area of Baltimore, along, you know, along the harbor. Harbor's increasingly being taken away and yuppified, but I've been painting the harbor 30, 40 years or so, and I mean, I was in kind of a paradise of decay, you know, like the banana is most tasty when it's just right on the edge of rot. And so, I mean, I kind of like the idea where nature is started to be, man makes nature, like wharves and buildings, and there's a kind of a gothic sense of when they're being reclaimed, when they've been no longer functional, you know, within the kind of fabric of kind of efficient society, they take on a life and an energy of otherness, and nature reclaims. I mean, the vines grow up, it crumbles, it does something like that. And that's the kind of stuff I really like. And I like that in people, too, that have, you know, lived, you know, they're not exactly, you know, the corporate successes, but rather that sort of thing. So I think the landscapes on that end, I like. Now, in nature, what I like to do a lot of times, I try in the woods, nature, the hardest thing in the world to do, because the light changes on a hillside, you got a couple hours. But in the woods, every moment you look at something, the light comes through trees, the rock's lit, and you look again, the rock's dark, and it's lit somewhere else. So there's this kind of pulsating energy, as I described it before, almost like athlete's muscle. You know, it's like a twitching, a kind of, everything twitches. Insects twitch, twigs twitch. You know, the corpulent kind of promiscuous imagery of concupiscence in the roots and rocks along the riverbank and stuff like that. They all are some sort of sexual interchange of, you don't know where you are in a sense. It's haunted. There's a kind of spooky quality, but it's like everything dissolves before your eyes. Any kind of resolve you have to make an image is immediately contradicted by the next moment. And they try, you really wrestle with the kind of spectral recalcitrance of nature to come under your command. So that in a sense is some of the landscape. The other thing is I love storms and cloud. I don't like blue skies. I don't like changelessness. I like the constant flux and change. And it's just like in the woods or something like that, and those dark kind of landscapes of enemy and neglect. Actually, the late light's the best, or the early light. I never get up that early, but the late light's terrific, where the light slants in and the moments of change are really very quick. And you're really amazed at the sheer dissolving beauty before your eyes, you know, the kind of accidents of color and the shimmer of things. You just have to navigate around this.
When Middleman paints, he's conscious of walking a mental tightrope between two modes of thinking, always balancing chaos on one hand while holding the reins of focus in the other. Lately, he's been painting small portraits, 10 by 12s, usually four or five of them a day, and the walls of his home studio are completely covered with a patchwork of these miniatures. One entire wall is checkered floor to ceiling with a dizzying collection of self-portraits.
It's kind of crazy when you see a whole wall of them, but, you know, each one is a little different. And there's a kind of intensity just by the small size, you know, where everything is kind of formulated within that small circumference.
What does it feel like to look at a wall full of a dozen of your own self-portraits?
It's a little mind-boggling, you know. I kind of put them up there. It's kind of fun because I want to see that each one is, and I think successfully does something different. You know, some of them are in the studio with still life and kind of act. Others are kind of frantic and disillusioned, you know. Others have a kind of arrogance to them, you know, kind of self-portrait arrogance. Some of them become a kind of a crazy gesture that I discovered, like that one on the end. They form a narrative of self. And not only this is only, you know, a few weeks' work, but I've been doing self-portraits by the hundreds all my life. And it's just something that I do, and it becomes a history of self, you know. So this is just a history of a month, say. And
have you ever lined up self-portraits from over the decades and looked at them all at once?
I think it'd be a damn interesting show just to put up self-portraits over the years. It's like looking at out a window at night, you know. You kind of look out and find what's in or something, you know. It's kind of, you know what I mean? When you look at, you see yourself in the glass, you know what I mean? It's like a proof of self in time, you know, and the exploration of that. And I've kind of taken on that. I think a lot of artists do that. It's not ego or kind of vanity or anything like that, I don't think, in my case. I think it's just that primal encounter with self.
Yeah, if you were to do a series like that, it would be sort of like two evolving selves on display, because it would be sort of your physiognomy changing over the years, but it would also be your experience and technique and style of representing it,
right,
that would be changing.
It would be changing all the time. So it's also like when you're very right on that. When you do the same thing, then you can see the changes you've made in your own technique. If you're constantly changing the subject matter, then that obscures the kind of growth that you made within the tactile formality of the profession itself, the way you've grown in that way, where your colors have deepened, whatever the things are that are happening, you know, the color, the form, the edges, all those things have become much more, you can see it better when the subject remains the same. We live in an age where we're constantly trying to change the outward subject. You know, like Lichtenstein will do like pop things one year, and the next year he'll do brush strokes, next year he'll do still, but his technique remains the same. And he still has dots, and he has a sense of design, you know, and he has, so it's not much that's really happening from a painterly point of view. But like Rembrandt did heads through his career, and there's a big change from the early Rembrandts to the late Rembrandts, even though they're still heads. And you can really see that change. And to me, that's really what's exciting, because the growth is there to some extent, you know, which is the manifest way you put the world together. The whole metaphysic of it becomes the interesting thing about the artist's contribution.
Thanks for taking the time to talk about all this tonight. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Well, likewise.
A selection of Raoul Mittelman's artwork is on display through the end of this weekend at the Roger LaPelle Gallery in Philadelphia, located at 122 North 3rd Street. And if you can't make the trip this weekend, you can look forward to some local exhibitions of the artist's work coming this spring at Baltimore's C. Grimaldus Gallery and at the Troika Gallery on Maryland's Eastern Shore. You can also find him on the web at www.raoulmittelman.com.